What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Colonel John Gold, a retired military intelligence officer discussing the threat of ISIS and Islamist terror in the world today. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's the final day of the 4th of July weekend, and I hope you all enjoyed great fireworks last night. While the economy of Greece melts down in debt and the European Union struggles to choke down panic about its currency, the euro, there is also some odd stuff going on relating to the U.S. Treasury, only it's not quite as serious a challenge. It turns out that our biggest issue right now is that our Orthodox Jewish Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, has decided, after almost 240 years of American history, it's high time for our currency to have a woman represented on a bill, and he has chosen to redesign the $10 bill to do just that. We have had ill-fated versions of U.S. coins with women's images on them before. Does anyone remember the unfortunate debacle of the Susan B. Anthony coin? It was supposed to supplant the dollar bill long ago. And Sacagawea was on a dollar coin too, although that also had problems with public acceptance and use. Unlike people in many other countries, we Americans have a problem actively using any coins larger than a quarter. We prefer, if we're going to spend cash, to use paper bills. And so, Lew has decreed that we're going to change the image on one of the bills we actually use, this would be the $10, to the image of a prominent American woman. Now, if you've not previously heard about this, I defy you to recall whose image is actually on the $10 bill right now. After you guess Washington or Lincoln, they are on the $1 and $5 bills, respectively. What are the chances you can remember that Alexander Hamilton is on the $10 bill, or Andrew Jackson, the 20, or Thomas Jefferson on the 2? And how about Ulysses Grant on the 50, Benjamin Franklin on the 100, William McKinley, of all people, on the $500 bill, and Grover Cleveland on the $1,000 bill? It also turns out that we have a $5,000 bill, helpful when paying for health insurance, with James Madison on board, a $10,000 bill with Civil War Treasury Secretary Salmon P. Chase as its face. You can use a few of those to pay for college tuition. And even a $100,000 bill that has Woodrow Wilson on it. That one can be used to buy your next Tesla, or if you have a few of them, a Maybach, perhaps a beach house. Anyway, none of these images are of Jews, and consequently you wouldn't think there'd be a Jewish angle on all of this. Who cares which of our past presidents or secretaries of the Treasury are on our currency and which will get replaced by Eleanor Roosevelt, Susan B. Anthony, Harriet Tubman, or Clara Barton? Turns out, of course, that there is a Jewish reason to care about this change. While everyone should applaud finally having a woman on a bill, never mind we still haven't had one in the White House or even as a major party nominee for president yet, there is some reason to care that the one guy who's going to be displaced to do this is Alexander Hamilton, the elegant 18th century gentleman's face of the $10. Because Hamilton's story is a fascinating one. It's entangled with the Jewish experience of the British colonies of his youth in the mid-1700s and with a new American nation that arose with him as one of its founding fathers. Alexander Hamilton was born on the British West Indies Caribbean island of Nevis around 1755. He also lived on St. Croix in the Danish Virgin Islands. His mother, Rachel Fawcett, was a colorful character of French Huguenot background, but possibly she had some Jewish heritage. He might have been halachically Jewish, even. And Rachel's husband was a Jewish merchant named Levian, or maybe Levine. She left him and her first son to run away with the fourth son of a Scottish lord, Lord James Hamilton, with whom she had Alexander and his brother James. Because of his illegitimate status, Hamilton was not allowed to attend the Anglican school, and instead he went to a Jewish school run in the Charleston Synagogue on Nevis. He learned Hebrew, could recite the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, in Hebrew for the rest of his life, and sometimes did. Alexander Hamilton admired and respected Jews. He wrote, "Progress of the Jews from their earliest history to the present time has been and is entirely out of the ordinary course of human affairs." Is it not then a fair conclusion that the cause also is an extraordinary one? In other words, that it is the effect of some great providential plan? In a court case, Hamilton once argued, "Why distrust the evidence of the Jews? Discredit them and you destroy the Christian religion." True enough. Fine words. So for Jack Lew, the Jewish Secretary of the Treasury, to remove Alexander Hamilton, the very first Secretary of the Treasury, founder of U.S. financial solvency, and, oh, by the way, the namesake of my own high school in Los Angeles, to take Hamilton off the $10 bill seems wrong. Why not swap out Andrew Jackson from the 20 instead? In any case, to play us in on this 4th of July weekend, on this hot morning, here's a novelty. America the Beautiful in Yiddish from the Jewish People's Philharmonic Chorus. America the Beautiful in Yiddish for this holiday weekend. When we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Colonel John Gold, a 30-year veteran of U.S. military intelligence, discussing ISIS, ISIL, and Islamic extremism and terrorism today. Find out where it comes from when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org. We welcome our guest on Too Jewish this morning. Colonel John Gold is a career military intelligence officer, served in the military intelligence branch for only 30 years. He retired in 2000. He's something of an expert on some of the great challenges facing our country and the world today in terms of terrorism and Islamist terrorism. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, a question that nobody seems exactly to have a clear answer for. What exactly is ISIS or ISIL?
ISIL is an evolution of Al-Qaeda. They moved into Syria and Iraq when we left.
And as an evolution of Al-Qaeda, which we think of as having been led by Osama bin Laden, and, you know, what does that... Clearly it makes them Islamist extremists who dislike the West. That's probably not nearly enough.
Just slightly different tactics. They were able to succeed because they took Osama's words literally. When you see a strong horse and a weak horse, people tend to like the strong horse. Whereas al-Qaeda focused on targeting the West directly, the United States, Europe, bombings, attacks in our country, ISIS said, let us make our own country, a country that is a safe haven for us to take over the world. Osama's plan, their plan, different tactics. The objective is the same.
So the Taliban controlled Afghanistan for a fairly long period of time. Is ISIS similar to the Taliban in its desire to control a country? Is it creating this new caliphate? How does that differ?
When the Taliban controlled Afghanistan, they provided a safe haven for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda's terrorist attacks on the world and the United States. And then we went in and removed the Taliban, in effect removing al-Qaeda's capability to act with impunity. Now they needed another place. ISIS said, let us have our own country where we don't have to depend on anybody else. And we have an ideal location. The American forces are pulling out of Iraq. There is a great vacuum because there is a rift between Sunni, Shia. The
only goes back 1,400 years.
Only 1,400 years they've been killing each other.
Right.
But they said, let's take advantage of this and let's show that we're the strong horse. The tactic is working.
And it's working dramatically in military fashion. Did anybody predict this?
Yes, all of our generals predicted this. I believe had the current administration, had my president listened to his military advisors, we would not have left a vacuum. We had stabilized Iraq. We had an opportunity to help it become a more stable country. I don't know that it ever could have become a democracy, at least not in my lifetime. It's not the history of the Islamist world. They are either ruled by religious dictators or military dictators. There are, I can't think of a country in the Middle East that is a true democracy.
So, except Israel.
Oh, yes, but that is not an Arab country.
So sometimes it's royal dictatorship. You know, it's not always specifically
it's
military.
It's a kingdom. It's a military leader. Right. Usually the kingdoms start out as the military leader who becomes the king. You can call him president all you want, but when his son becomes the next president and the next president, you know what to call it.
Yeah. We will talk much more with Colonel John Gold and explore both ISIS and ISIL and sort of what devolved in Iraq and how it affects Israel as well when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish. Now I want to express my thanks. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm glad and grateful that the modest cash awards we started with some 10 years ago have grown into a rather substantial amount with the help of donors like many of you. The Kohan Foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan of blessed memory, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the whole Jewish people. That service can be in one of four areas: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. Our past award winners include some truly amazing people, and we are grateful for the chance to reward them and their fine work. Do you know of someone who could qualify for a Kohan Award in 2015? Or will you consider participating in this work yourself? Please go to our website, www.kohanaward.com, KohanAward.com, where you can find all the information on nominating and on participating in this great work. And we'll be glad to hear from you. Our goal is to help people who work for the whole Jewish people. We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all our shows from there or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. After a couple of weeks, when President Obama had what might well have been his best time in office, it's time to go forward. Although we still have 16 months to go until the election for President of the United States, Hillary Clinton has been running for the Democratic nomination, well, for years, and nearly everyone in America has officially declared themselves as candidates for the Republican nomination for president. In that questionable spirit, it's time to begin our special election year or so coverage, the 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. We offer in-depth coverage, unusual features, and the finest opinion available on the air as we choose the new leader for our nation. And there are always Jewish angles on these races. There are currently 14 announced Republican candidates, unless we missed another one while we were airing this show. Who isn't running for president on the Republican side? And there are 4 Democrats in the race for president, but so far, only one of those 20 people is actually Jewish. Today, we highlight the long-shot Democratic candidate, Bernie Sanders, Vermont senator, who, if he won, would be the very first Jewish president of the United States. This past week, Sanders' visit to Madison, Wisconsin made history. He drew the biggest crowd of any of the 2016 presidential candidates, and the AP estimated the turnout as 10,000 people. Although Hillary Clinton is the assumed nominee, Sanders' early popularity among Democrats, especially young ones, has been startling. Bernie Sanders was born and grew up in Flatbush, Brooklyn, son of a Jewish immigrant from Poland who lost most of his family in the Holocaust. Sanders was bar mitzvahed in 1954 and spent a few months after college on a kibbutz in Israel. He credits his Jewish identity with teaching him in a very deep way what politics is about, explaining that a guy named Adolf Hitler won an election in 1932. He won an election and 50 million people died as a result of that election in World War II, including 6 million Jews. So what I learned as a little kid is that politics is in fact very important. Bernie Sanders of Vermont is the longest tenured independent senator in the history of the country, although he caucuses with the Democrats and is certainly the only socialist in the race. Sanders favors a Scandinavian-style social democrat approach to government and is considered to have very little chance, but he is certainly making an early splash, and his Jewish identity is firmly established. That was our first 2016 presidential election report from a Jewish perspective. Only 16 more months to go. I can hardly wait. We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshart Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, Boker Tov Oshrat.
Good morning, Gabay.
Good morning and happy end of 4th of July weekend.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach is right. So I want to talk a little bit about the Israeli perception of American leadership. Current relationship with President Obama is not popular in Israel. George W. Bush was very popular in Israel. But Bill Clinton was also very popular in Israel, and George H.W. Bush was not popular. So it doesn't seem to just be related to party. But boy, there's certainly, you could say there's a bipartisan approach to Israelis. What is it that makes an Israeli populace like an American president?
It's, you know, Israelis like Israelis. You can't understand them, right? So I think that until the last election or until President Obama, it was very clear that whatever the differences or argument. There is a strong relationship between the people and the administration that was beyond the argument. And this is the first time I think that it's really the gap or the it goes beyond the administration of the two states, and the people of Israel really feels that we kind of the relationship kind of been cold. Can I use this?
But not like
people to people, I would say. I think I know for sure, but I don't know if the Israelis knows that there's still like more than 70% of the Americans that will support Israel no matter what. And there is always this 8 to 10% that won't support us.
No matter what.
And there is 20 that are floating. But again, it's the perception that it's the relationship are less warm than it used to be. But it's only a perception.
I think it's a perception. You know, it's interesting because the Congress couldn't be much more supportive of Israel. Sometimes almost too supportive of Israel. So I agree with you that it's not the American populace. But it does seem to me that the Israeli perception focuses to a much greater degree on whoever's in the White House and the level of support for Israel that's perceived.
It makes the headlines, you know, not someone from Tucson make the headlines.
Right.
At the end of the day, that's, yeah.
It's not the senator from Missouri or the congressperson from one of the very warm community districts here in Tucson.
It's the...
Right.
Yeah.
It's the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I certainly hope that that perception improves because as the only democracy in the Middle East and one of America's greatest allies, Israel certainly has tremendous connection to the United States and to our values.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's where many, many Israelis that during this weekend celebrated 4th of July.
4th of July, I'm sure. Maybe even with fireworks.
So everything is okay.
Thanks, Oshron. We'll talk next
Toda
week.
Tada rabai.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
All right, so we've been talking about Israel. I have a question for you. What's the difference between an Israeli breakfast, the famed, fantastic spread you get in an Israeli hotel, and a Turkish or Ottoman breakfast?
Well, when you go to a five-star hotel in Turkey, you get almost exactly the same thing you get at a five-star hotel in Israel, with one significant difference. In Turkey, if you're lucky, you get smoked salmon. That's it. In Israel, there's three or four or six kinds of smoked fish.
Or 10 kinds.
Herring, smoked white fish, whatever. And that was brought to Israel, not by anybody native to Israel, but by Jews from Baltic Sea countries, whether Poland, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, whatever, right. Jews from that part of the world contributed to Israeli culture the same way that many other portions of the Israel's population also contributed and slightly modified that traditional Ottoman breakfast into what we consider the Israeli breakfast today.
Which I think is a wonderful example. Israel is a country made up of people who have come from well over 200 countries, perhaps 50 of which don't even exist anymore, all contributing into this complicated mix and creating a very dynamic, interesting, intellectually fertile country in which they draw on everybody.
And of course, they had a great model for that because Israel, or what was then called Palestine, was for centuries part of the Ottoman Empire. And the way the Ottomans achieved their greatest heights back in the 16th, 17th, even 18th century was by drawing on the talents and gifts and abilities of minority populations, Greeks, Armenians, Jews, et cetera, et cetera.
Kurds, you name it.
Right. And I just saw a fabulous example of that. So the same trip that I visited Israel, a later stop was Serbia and Bosnia, and particularly a city in Bosnia called Visegrad, which is where a very famous bridge exists over the river Drina. And the bridge was immortalized by Nobel Prize winning author Ivo Andrić in a book called Bridge on the Drina. And it's a book that everybody should read, but it describes this wonderful bridge that was built by the Ottomans early in the 16th century, really when they were at their peak. They built enormously beautiful and important bridges at strategic points all through the Balkans. But this particular bridge was designed by Sinan, who was the most famous, well-known of the Ottoman architects, designed a lot of the great mosques in the empire, a lot of the great public structures like bridges. And he, of course, was Armenian.
And he has a great tomb, by the way, in Istanbul. I mean, right. Incredible the way that drawing on all of these diverse populations actually builds and develops a country in a way that, you know, a more homogeneous place simply can't.
If the country doesn't fall apart, which obviously the Ottoman Empire did, and Yugoslavia also did. And I mean, this place where this Ottoman bridge exists was one of the flashpoints where the interests of three great empires conflicted. The Habsburg Empire, also representing the Roman Catholic Church, the Tsarist Empire representing the Orthodox Church, and the Ottoman Empire representing Islam. And, you know, each of those empires had a different alphabet, a different state religion, a whole different governmental apparatus, and their interests conflicted always right there in the heart of the Balkans, where this gorgeous bridge, and it's a very tranquil, peaceful little town today.
But that area has not been so.
Exactly.
Thanks, Dom. We'll talk next week.
Looking forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The old rabbi is in the hospital, barely conscious, surrounded by worried congregants. "What a great speaker. His sermons were so inspiring," says one. "He's the best rabbi ever," agrees another, "and a great fundraiser. He took such good care of his family. He always had time for them, no matter how busy he was. And what a brilliant teacher," says another congregant. "He could patiently explain Torah, Talmud, Zohar, everything to anyone, no matter how hard the text or how ignorant the student. And a community leader, too. He was the best." After that, everyone falls silent. After a few minutes of calm, the rabbi weakly opens one eye and says, "And about my modesty, you say nothing?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. This week we read a portion from the middle of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. It's named after a man named Pinchas, whose story really began at the end of last week's portion of Balak. The situation's familiar. For the umpteenth time, the people of Israel have been disobeying the Torah and worshiping other gods. This time, the apostasy has reached epidemic proportion. Even the elite leadership of the people has begun to sample the religious wares of the Midianites and Moabites. Finally, one of the princes of the people challenges the authority of Moses publicly. He takes a sacred prostitute into his tent, and the whole assembly watches. As Moses and the other elders stand by in shock, unable to respond to such a chutzpahdik act, a young Kohen, a priest named Pinchas, steps forward. He kills the wayward prince and his consort and breaks the spell of the false religious practice. For this act, Pinchas is rewarded by God, which seems to validate his violent vigilantism. But there is more to the story than meets the eye, for Pinchas' reward for killing the couple is a breach shalom, a covenant of peace. Neither he nor any of his descendants is ever again permitted to go to war or even carry a spear. He must minister to the needs of the tabernacle, the rituals of the altar and of purification and sacrifice. He can never engage in any more acts of violence. Pinchas has broken the Israelites' latest fascination with paganism, but never again will that level of religious violence be tolerated. It must instead be sublimated to serve the needs of the community, an ongoing lesson about the dangers of religious fanaticism. Judaism refuses to countenance this kind of religious insanity, the kind that led to the Crusades, or Jihad, or the Inquisition, or ISIS, or any religious terrorism. In spite of the occasional anomaly, our religious fervor is never designed to lead to violence. We are committed, fervently and firmly, to the same breach shalom, the covenant of peace, that God places on Pinchas. So may it always be. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Colonel John Gold, a Jewish guy from New York who spent 30 years as an Army intelligence officer, will explore the sources of the current wave of Islamist terrorism we are experiencing worldwide and what we might do about ISIS and other such threats in the coming days. Find out when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7030.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
There's just one story today, but it's amazing. Sir Nicholas Winton, the Briton who said nothing for a half century about his role organizing the escape of 669 mostly Jewish children from Czechoslovakia on the eve of World War II, died last week in England. He was 106 years old. Winton was often compared to Oskar Schindler, the German who saved 1,200 Jews in his factories in Poland and Czechoslovakia, and to Raoul Wallenberg, the Swedish businessman and diplomat who used illegal passports and saved tens of thousands of Jews in Nazi-occupied Hungary. Winton was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II in 2003 for his righteous deeds, but Winton was a most reluctant hero who hid his work for more than 50 years. He found the late attention paid to his acts of salvation unbelievable. The story began back in December 1938, when Nicholas Winton was a London stockbroker. On an impulse, he canceled a Swiss skiing vacation and flew to Prague at the request of a friend who was aiding refugees in the Sudetenland, the western part of Czechoslovakia that had just been annexed by Germany. "Don't bother to bring your skis," the friend, Martin Blake, told him. Winton found vast camps of refugees living in appalling conditions. The Nazi pogroms of Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass, had destroyed Jewish shops, homes, and synagogues in Germany and Austria. War looked inevitable, and escape, especially for children, seemed hopeless, given the restrictions against Jewish immigration in the West. Britain was a minor exception, literally. In late 1938, Britain began a program called the Kinder Transport to admit unaccompanied Jewish children up to age 17 if they had a host family, with an offer of a £50 guarantee for an eventual return ticket. The refugee children's movement in Britain sent representatives to Germany and Austria, and 10,000 Jewish children were saved before the war began. But there was no comparable mass rescue effort in Czechoslovakia. So, Nicholas Winton created one. It took bribes, forgery, secret contacts with the Gestapo, 9 railroad trains, an avalanche of paperwork, great danger, and a lot of money. Nazi agents followed him. In his Prague hotel room, he met terrified parents desperate to get their children to safety, even though it meant surrendering them to strangers in a strange land. As their numbers grew, a storefront office was opened. Long lines attracted Gestapo attention. Perilous confrontations were resolved with bribes. Eventually, Winton registered more than 900 children, although he had names and details on 5,000. In early 1939, he left two friends, Trevor Chadwick and Bill Barazzetti, in charge in Prague and went back to London to find foster homes, raise money, and arrange transportation. Winton and a few volunteers, including his mother, called themselves the British Committee for Refugees from Czechoslovakia Children's Section. They enlisted aid from the Refugee Children's Movement, printed photos of the children, appealed for funds in foster homes and newspaper ads and church and synagogue bulletins. Hundreds of families volunteered to take children, and money trickled in from donors. Not enough to cover all the costs, but Winton made up the difference himself. He appealed to the Home Office for entry visas, but the response was slow. Time was short. This was a few months before the war broke out, Winton recalled, so he forged the Home Office entry permits. In Prague, his man Chadwick quietly cultivated the chief of the Gestapo, Karl Bemelberg. They called him the Criminal Rat after his inspector's rank of Kriminalrat, and arranged for forged transport papers and bribes to be passed to key Nazis and Czech railway officials who threatened to halt trains or seize the children unless they were paid off. Winton sent more money, some for bribes, some for expenses, for children whose parents had been arrested and shot or fled into hiding. Many of the Czech families sold possessions to pay for their kids' escape. March 14, 1939, it all came together. Hours before Hitler dismembered the Czech provinces of Bohemia and Moravia as a German protectorate, the first 20 children left Prague on a train. Survivors told of the searing scenes on the station platform in the moments before departure. Children sobbed and pleaded not to be sent away, and parents faced giving up their kids. Winton and his colleagues arranged for 8 more trains to get the rest of the children out, crossing the Third Reich through Nuremberg and Cologne to Holland, then across the North Sea by boat to England and on by British rail to the Liverpool Street station in London. There, Nicholas Winton and host families met the children. Each refugee had a small bag and wore a name tag. Only 7 of the 8 trains made it through, the last in early August. The total rescued was 669. About 250 children, the largest group, were on board the last train out September 1st, 1939. But on that day, Hitler invaded Poland. All borders controlled by Germany were closed, and Winton's rescue efforts came to an end. Within hours of the announcement, the train disappeared, he recalled. None of the 250 children aboard was ever seen again. All are believed to have been murdered in concentration camps by the Nazis. Nearly all the saved children were orphans by the end of the war, their parents killed at Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, or Theresienstadt. After the war, many stayed in Britain, but others went back to Czechoslovakia or went to Israel, Australia, or the U.S. The survivors, many in their 70s and 80s, still call themselves Winton's children. Winton's family were originally German Jews, but his parents had converted to Christianity and changed their names. He himself grew up the British privileged child of an Anglican merchant banker. He had a long, successful career in finance and as a stockbroker was an RAF officer during the war and later worked for the International Refugee Organizations and a charity for the elderly. In 1983, he got the Order of the British Empire, the OBE, for his charity work. But for 50 years, he said nothing about the Czech children's rescue, not even to his wife, Greta. In 1988, his wife found a scrapbook in the attic of their home in Maidenhead outside of London about his work of deliverance for children destined for the concentration camps and extermination half a century earlier. The long hidden scrapbook was crammed with names, pictures, letters from families, travel documents, and notes crediting colleagues. His wife asked for an explanation. He gave her a general idea and said he thought the papers had no value, suggested discarding them. "You can't throw those papers away," she responded. "They are children's lives." I did not think for one moment that they would be of interest to anyone so long after it happened, Winton recalled. She gave the scrapbook to a Holocaust historian, a newspaper article followed, then a BBC TV program featured it, and the publicity went worldwide. Nicholas Winton was showered with encomiums, the Czech Republic's highest award, the Honorary Citizenship of Prague, an American congressional resolution, letters of appreciation from President George W. Bush, Prime Minister Tony Blair, former President Aser Weizmann of Israel, a nomination by the Czech Republic for the Nobel Peace Prize. His scrapbook went to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial in Israel. Streets and schools were named for him. Statues went up in Prague and London. Winton was incredulous at his fame, shook his head in bewilderment and disbelief when compared to Oscar Schindler or Raoul Wallenberg. But on September 1, 2009, 70 years after the onset of the war halted rescue operations, a special train with a locomotive and carriages from the 30s left Prague to recreate the perilous 1939 journeys. On board were some of the original Winton's children, many of their descendants, whose numbers now exceed 6,000. They were met at Liverpool Street Station by Nicholas Winton, who had just turned 100 years old. Zecher Tzadik Livracha, may the memory of this great righteous man be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Colonel John Gold is a career military intelligence officer, served in the military intelligence branch for 30 years. He was tactical and strategic intelligence officer, a certified counterterrorism instructor, special security officer, held top secret clearance, and served as assistant foreign policy advisor for the U.S. Pacific Command. Had a couple of tours of duty as chief military intelligence officer for the UN pre-deployment forces in the former Yugoslavia as well. We started speaking, John, at the beginning of the program about ISIS and ISIL and the kind of deconstruction of Iraq. If it's not too much, I want to go slightly into the history of Iraq. Iraq was kind of put together as a post-colonial entity, and it's never been clear to me that it's an actual country.
There's an agreement called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. There was no such country as Iraq or most of the Middle Eastern countries that we know today. 100 years ago, there was the time of empires. You had the Austro-Hungarian Empire, where a lot of our Jewish ancestors came from.
A lot.
We had the Russian Empire, where even more of our Jewish ancestors came from. We had the Germanic, quote-unquote, Germany, Prussia. We had the, what do we used to call that fellow, the Kaiser?
The Kaiser,
right. We had a lot of ancestors who came from those areas.
The Ottoman Empire.
Yes. The problem with the Middle East that we see today was basically the last Islamic caliphate, which was called the Ottoman Empire. People don't realize it, but the largest empires in the world were the Islamic empires. Also, the largest genocides in the world were the Islamist genocides.
Although I think World War II and the Holocaust might have modified that a little bit along
Actually,
the way.
Actually, no. Actually, no, but they were the largest in modern times. When the Ottomans, who were the rulers of the last Islamist empire, joined the wrong side in World War I, they were defeated, and just as we dissolved the Austro-Hungarian Empire, we also dissolved the Ottoman Empire. And it went from a gigantic region which encompassed the entire Middle East to just Turkey. And then the victors of World War I, the Allies, Britain, France, and to a lesser extent Russia, divided the Middle East into spheres of influence, the French sphere of influence. They made up countries. And the British sphere of influence, and they made up countries. Hence you have an Iraq, a Lebanon, a Jordan,
Saudi Arabia.
These were all simply the Ottoman Empire, and it was the Ottoman regions of the area. No names, no countries, just backwater, primitive areas.
And those were sometimes cobbled together from regions that included Sunni in one area, Shia in another, Kurds, you know, all sort of squished together into one country. Iraq sort of matches that description.
Iraq is exactly that, a conglomeration of warring tribes put into one country where the other half of the other tribe could have been in Iran, and the other half of one tribe could have been in Jordan, and the other half of one tribe became Lebanon. It was an area that had Sunni, Shia, all the different branches of Sunni and Shia, like we have all the different sects of Judaism and all the different branches of Christianity. The same thing was true, but they were more tribal in the Muslim world, and they were just haphazardly divided into spheres of influence controlled by, owned by, the French and the British.
So with the eventual devolution of those British and French spheres of influence, the end of, I know the British Empire still exists in a few places in the world, but the end of colonialism and the rise of some form of Arab nationalism, and really all of it post-World War II, when all of this, you know, came together. Iraq, like so many other countries in the Middle East, everyone except Israel, not a democracy, some kind of autocracy always existed. When Saddam Hussein was toppled, Iraq became sort of an American protectorate for a while. Can you describe that process?
Sadly, I can. I believe that we had an issue that was thrust upon us under the presidency of George Bush the First, where Saddam Hussein decided that he was going to take Kuwait and Saudi Arabia.
And it should be noted, all of their oil supplies as well.
Well, that's why he was going to take these areas. And America got half of its oil, maybe more of its oil at that point in time, from the Middle East, from these countries. It was our strategic interests in the area that were now affected by this action, because we didn't want to spend $20, $30, $40 a gallon for gasoline as it becomes scarce. So what George Bush the First did was he sent a proper military force in, what is called a dominant military force, to push him out of Kuwait and take away his ability to harm our strategic interests. And we know it as Desert Storm. What people don't realize is he did it right. He simply took out the ability to wage war of a country militarily, but not the government that held it together. We had, I think, 48 casualties, most of them friendly fire. And people don't realize we probably killed 250,000 of heavily armored, probably the largest Arab military force in the Middle East. And that was a proper victory. The only trouble was with the second George Bush. When Saddam Hussein fooled the world into believing he had nuclear weapons, and he did fool the world. That's pretty common knowledge today, but not at the time. We thought he had nuclear weapons. You got to remember, the Israelis took out the Syrian reactor. I believe they also took out an Iraqi reactor.
They did in 1982, yes. I think, a long time ago.
And now we went in because we thought that he had rebuilt a nuclear arsenal. Remember, North Korea supplies stuff, and these people have money to pay for it. It's oil money. So the second George Bush took out Iraq's military and took out its leadership. What he failed to recognize, and this is probably Monday morning quarterbacking, even though he should have been aware, he upset a balance. Iraq Sunni balanced Iran Shia. It is the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Islamic Republic of Iraq. By definition, their goal, if you read any of their, just the charters, and I can read it to you because I have it, is domination of the world. So right now, as long as one was fighting the other, everything was balanced. But George Bush II left Iran and decimated Iraq. Had we stayed to balance Iran, or had we at that point in time simply said to the Iranians, hey, it's time for you to realize you have to become more liberal. The student revolution that is happening in your country, and it continued over under Obama, it really flourished under him. Instead of supporting them and changing the face of Iran today, we are left with a dominant power in the Middle East, developing nuclear technology.
So Iraq destabilized, now ISIL in control of large sectors of Iraq. Iran continuing to develop nuclear power. Various agreements may be effective, but not apparently so. What's the future? What do you see in the next few years here? It doesn't look pretty from our perspective.
Well, as a student of history, you either learn from history or you're destined to repeat it. We've seen this before. 200 years ago, our founding fathers fought our first war after independence against the Islamists. It was called the Barbary Wars.
Yeah, the Barbary Pirates.
The Barbary Pirates. What we fail to remember is they were the Islamist pirates. Now, I hear I got to make a statement. I'm not anti-Muslim. I am anti-Islamist, and there's a difference. It's critical for me as a soldier to use a word that identifies an enemy through the content of his character as opposed to the color of his skin, ethnicity, or religious beliefs. This distinguishes an enemy from neutrals and friends. The term Islamist or militant Islamist acknowledges this enemy's similarity to a Muslim, but refuses to acknowledge his equality to a Muslim. And one last sentence. Militant Islamists are to Islam what Nazis were to Germany. Practitioners of a despicable subhuman behavioral choice that's as much a menace to decent Muslims as Nazism was to decent Germans. Islamists kill more Muslims than anybody else.
By a large margin, I think.
If I wanted to say since 1948, I believe I have statistics. Since 1948, I think there were 10 million Muslims who've been murdered by Islamists. 2.5 million Hindus who've been murdered by Islamists in our lifetimes. We remember when India was separated into Pakistan and Bangladesh and East Bangladesh and East Pakistan and West Pakistan. I don't even remember the names that they were. But you had 2.5 million Hindus murdered. And today they are murdering Muslims by the millions and 10,000 Christians every year since 9/11.
The Israel's perspective on this, I think, is a guarded neutrality to some degree. If you look at what's happening in the, say, Syrian civil war, which in many ways was the impetus for ISIS to become public, at least in the West, for us to understand what they were and how quickly they were growing. From the Israeli perspective, at first, they weren't quite sure who to support, and it's not clear that the U.S. has anybody that they're clear on supporting in the Syrian civil war. Assad has always been an enemy of Israel and an enemy of America as well. Now Assad is fighting ISIS, and so what do we think about that here?
There's an adage in the Middle East, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that has been for 2,000 years. The Israelis realize the new reality. The enemy of my enemy is my enemy. There is no good here. Saddam Hussein is bad. ISIS is bad. The mullahs running Iran are bad. There is no good in this region. We are talking about bad people who will annihilate the Jews. I mean, since 1948, people don't realize there were almost 1 million Jews in what we know as the Arab lands today. In 1948, 1 million Jews, they never left the Middle East. Today, less than 10,000.
Yeah, almost all immigrated, almost predominantly to Israel.
Immigrated or dead.
Yeah.
This is nothing new.
Right.
The enemy of my enemy is my enemy. As far as Israel's concerned, they have a dominant combat power in a particular region, in that area, regional power. The people fighting each other are their enemies, and they know it, because the minute the fighting stops, they will turn on Israel. Israel simply has to say, we have to keep the ability to exterminate the Jews out of the picture. Israel has an existential threat. the Islamic Republic of Iran. They are developing nuclear energy. I can understand nuclear energy for medical purposes. You want to use uranium, you need 500 centrifuges, 1,000 centrifuges is beyond comprehension. They have 16,000 centrifuges for purifying uranium above 20% so that you can make something. The only thing you make above that is nuclear weapons. But forget uranium for the moment. They have a plutonium reactor. There is no use for plutonium other than a bomb. Plutonium is the deadliest material on Earth. One speck in a crowded auditorium, and everyone in that auditorium will die, even if it doesn't explode. That's how deadly that stuff is. They are developing plutonium. Now, you tell me that's for peaceful purposes, and I will sell you a Brooklyn Bridge at a very good price.
Yes, even if it's already in Arizona. John, I want to thank you for a great visit with Colonel John Gold here on Too Jewish. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi, for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Sigal Samuel, author of the new novel, The Mystics of the Mile End. Our playout this morning comes from Doug Kotler for the 4th of July weekend. It's Jewish USA, in tribute to the recent movie about Brian Wilson, Mercy and Grace, and I don't know, maybe to the Jewish guy running for president, Bernie Sanders, too. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. If everybody had a Torah.